The Obama era ends in enormous opportunity and crushing pain for Black America. His presidency saved hundreds of thousands of Black lives, even as the nation watched a parade of Black deaths. As part of our series, The Obama Years, The View from New York, Kai Wright reflects. This story was adapted from The Nation magazine.
Any history of Black people in America will have to look closely at the year 2014. That year, in a cascading series of events, Barack Obama's legacy as the nation's first Black president began to appear. The best of it and the worst.
Every time you see me, you want to harass me, you want to stop me, you want to sell cigarettes. I'm minding my business, officer.
It started with Eric Garner on July 17.
I can't breathe.
By the time the 2016 election began, you needed only to say Ferguson or Baltimore, or Michael Brown or Sandra Bland, and you'd described the grim state of affairs. A presidency that began with enormous hope in Black America was concluding with widespread outrage.
I can't breathe!
But something else happened in 2014. Obamacare launched. That spring, before people started taking over the streets in anger over Black death, I met a man named Robert Woodward at Newark's Beth Israel Hospital. He was in the middle of a personal celebration of Black life.
You have to excuse that, no, but that's why I got that on here, because I'm happy.
It's a great song.
Oh, hey.
Robert was just sitting down to apply for Medicaid, something he'd been unable to do for the past decade or so while living down in North Carolina. He told me he'd had at least 8 heart attacks in that time. Each time it happened, he went to the emergency room, and then he went right back to work.
What can you do? Just let it add up, because you can't pay it. Yeah.
So how much would you get a bill for?
Outrageous. But when you can't pay it, you just can't pay it. You know, I'm a poor Black man, you know.
Neither Barack Obama nor his detractors have talked about the Affordable Care Act as a racial justice or anti-poverty program. But it is both things. Between the January 2014 launch of new coverage options and Michael Brown's killing, Medicaid grew by roughly 7 million people. As of last summer, it had gone up by more than 10 million people. Millions more have bought private insurance using subsidies. And here's one striking measure. By the end of 2014, in just 1 year's time, Obamacare had entirely erased the disparity in health coverage between white and Black kids. Zeroed it out. That kind of thing never happens. Most racial disparities have been with us unmoved for generations.
We the people, in order to form...
Obama's most famous race speech is still his first. Delivered in March 2008 in reaction to a media uproar over his relationship with Reverend Jeremiah Wright. In his opening words, candidate Obama reckoned with the signing of the Declaration of Independence.
It was stained by this nation's original sin of slavery.
But he went on to argue that the brilliance of America is that our founding documents empower us to fight our own demons.
What we know, what we have seen, is that America can change. That is the true genius of this nation.
And of course he'd feel this idea, as he would say, deep in his bones. Everything about Barack Obama's life story suggests to him that the United States is a remarkable, if deeply flawed, work in progress. And in this sense, he is part of a long line of Black political actors who understand the Constitution doesn't protect us, it arms us in a persistent, even permanent fight for justice. What separates Obama from this political lineage is his profound faith in both the possibility and the power of national unity. And that's how he first stole the show, back in 2004 at the Democratic Convention.
There is not a Black America and a white America and Latino America and Asian America. There's the United States of America.
The Democratic Party has for years clung to this enticing idea about race politics. They figure if you just argue for a more fair and just society broadly, you can get rid of racial inequities without a divisive fight over racism. It's what writer Nicole Hannah-Jones has called trickle-down liberalism. Barack Obama not only embraced this doctrine, he came to literally embody it. And he spent the weeks between the deaths of Eric Garner and Michael Brown implicitly making the case for it.
America's making progress. We're better off now than we were 5 years ago. We're going to be better off 5 years from now than we are right now, despite the unyielding opposition of a few.
It was an off-cycle election year, and he pled with his increasingly grumpy coalition to see the economic recovery that was finally taking hold. And you know what? He was right. Over the following year, median household income grew more than any year on record. That growth appeared in all racial and ethnic groups and across all income brackets. Poverty fell more sharply than it had since 1968, again, across almost every racial and ethnic group. And this was notable because ever since the 2001 recession, Black communities have been uniquely battered by both poverty and unemployment. But by studiously avoiding a fight over racism and crafting his economic policies as universal investments, Obama was indeed achieving more opportunity for everybody. There was just one problem with this failure to name or target racism.
His grandmother in Kenya said he was born in Kenya and she was there and witnessed the birth, okay? He doesn't have a birth certificate or he hasn't shown it.
Obama's allegiance to a race-neutral, unifying message does not account for the fact that there are powerful political forces who have no qualms making direct appeals to race.
Giving all praise and honor to God.
Obama's second most famous race speech is one of the last he delivered on the subject, in which he eulogized nine Black people murdered by a white supremacist in a Charleston church.
For too long, we've been blind to the way past injustices continue to shape the present.
That's right.
Perhaps we see that now. Perhaps this tragedy causes us to ask some tough questions about how we can permit so many of our children to languish in poverty.
Which is the kind of question the Affordable Care Act, at least in part, tried to answer. For millions of Black people like Newark's Robert Woodward, the man with repeated heart attacks, Obamacare saved their lives. But like much of Obama's universalist agenda, the law now faces near certain repeal. So we step forward with Obama's twin legacies. His presidency was a period of both crushingly hard times and enormous opportunity for Black Americans.
Amazing grace.
It brought real clarity on the grave threat America continues to present for people of color, politically, economically, physically. And it brought a growing mobilization of people who are now ready to fight explicitly for racial justice. For WNYC, I'm Kai Wright.
Amazing grace. How sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I
Almost 8 years ago, Barack Obama took the oath of office amid the deepest recession in decades.
This crisis has reminded us that without a watchful eye, the market can spin out of control. The nation cannot prosper long when it favors only the prosperous.
As part of our series, The Obama Years, The View from New York, WNYC's Ilya Meritz reports that Obama's policies aimed at saving the nation's economy often helped New York the most, by helping Wall Street first.
Let's go back to the time right before Obama became president, September 2008.
Lehman Brothers suffering a spectacular downfall.
Lehman Brothers, stone-faced men and women carrying the remains of their jobs in cardboard boxes onto the streets of Midtown Manhattan. It was the country's biggest ever corporate bankruptcy. In New York, one job in 10 is connected to finance. The meltdown on Wall Street quickly spread to the rest of the nation.
Listen, I think people forget how brutal it was.
This is Robert Wolf. He's been a friend and advisor to President Obama.
We were losing, I think at the point, was around 800,000 plus jobs per month.
At the time Obama became leader of the free world in 2009, Wolf was president of an international bank, UBS. He's also a true blue Democrat. Robert Kennedy is his namesake. And you guessed it, his older brother is named John. Wolf became known as Obama's buddy on Wall Street. He relished that role, and he still does.
Even today, when I debate my friends, okay, tell me which policy really hurt the business sector, especially financial services, they struggle with that debate.
So, in his first 2 years, Obama rolled out one dramatic measure after another aimed at saving the economy. He continued the bailout of banks, begun by President Bush. He got a massive economic stimulus. There were programs to help struggling homeowners with their mortgages, and new rules were being written to rein in reckless behavior at banks. As Obama's first year in office drew to a close in 2009, there was this contradiction. Wall Street had clearly stabilized. Stock markets were rising, but people were losing their jobs. Unemployment reached the highest level in a quarter century.
Some Wall Street banks have now recovered to the point where they can not only afford to pay back the loans, but once again hand out huge bonuses to their employees.
The president went on 60 Minutes with reporter Steve Croft.
I did not run for office to be helping out a bunch of fat cat bankers on Wall Street.
Obama was willing to occasionally hurt bankers' feelings, but he wasn't willing to let their industry fail. And that was good for New York. Robert Wolf.
New York City had a quick rebound, partly because financial services came back.
By 2011, the city had recovered the total number of jobs lost in the Great Recession. It took the rest of the nation 3 more years to catch up. This uneven recovery seemed unfair to many Americans. In 2009, anger over the bailouts sparked a new movement on the right, the Tea Party. The next year, Republicans won majorities in Congress. Even here in liberal New York, there was also bailout rage, but it took a different form. September 17th, 2011, over 1,000 protesters tried to march on Wall Street. Police blocked their way, and the protesters formed a camp in nearby Zuccotti Park. People slept there every night. Celebrities visited, Kanye West and Alec Baldwin. Whatever Occupy Wall Street was, it sure was something. Occupy didn't have concrete demands, but long after it ended, President Obama was still picking up on Occupy's themes, like in this speech in 2013.
The combined trends of increased inequality and decreasing mobility pose a fundamental threat to the American dream, our way of life, and what we stand for around the globe.
For Sarah Ludwig of the New Economy Project, these were the right words. But Obama had already missed his chance to help some of the people most affected by the crisis, which after all had begun with bad mortgages. Central Brooklyn and Southeast Queens were full of struggling homeowners.
You'd have 5, 6, 7 foreclosure actions on one block just repeated throughout neighborhoods.
Obama offered a bunch of programs to help people in foreclosure, but he wasn't prepared to force the banks to forgive debt.
The programs that came out of the Obama administration to deal with the foreclosure crisis were, I think it's not an exaggeration to say, something of a travesty. The banks that had caused this crisis didn't actually have to do anything to set things straight for people.
She says very few homeowners she worked with managed to actually get the terms of their mortgages changed and stay in their homes. Still, after Obama's interventions, the nation's economy did grow again, slowly. Losing control of Congress in 2010 meant the president couldn't make any more big moves. Instead, it was the Federal Reserve, headed by Obama appointee Ben Bernanke, that did something drastic.
It's called QE2, and we're not talking about a cruise ship. Quantitative easing and why this matters.
The central bank started buying up huge amounts of bonds, basically flooding the system with money. The idea was this could help Main Street catch up with Wall Street. The Fed did a round of quantitative easing in 2010, and when things hadn't improved enough in 2013, they did it again.
The Fed announced plans to buy up mortgage debt, and a lot of it, to the tune of $40 billion a month.
Once again, it was a very financial, very Wall Street solution aimed at the problems of Main Street. Robert Wolf says the U.S. dollar lost value, and as it happens, that really helped New York.
And when the dollar's weak, okay, New York City probably benefits the most because of travel and tourism.
You could feel it. Times Square became so crowded with tourists, Mayor Bloomberg turned the surrounding streets into a pedestrian plaza. Employment reports showed a surge in restaurant and hotel jobs, and thousands of New Yorkers tried to get a piece of the hospitality action by listing their homes on Airbnb. In time, another effect of the weak dollar also became apparent. One by one, these super tall residential skyscrapers appeared on the horizon south of Central Park. And in Brooklyn neighborhoods that used to be synonymous with crime, elegant new condos appeared.
A lot of individuals from Asia and the Middle East wanted to buy dollar assets. The best dollar assets to buy often is real estate.
Sarah Ludwig sees it as a 1-2 punch. Some neighborhoods in the boroughs that had been rocked by foreclosure now got gentrification on steroids.
You just have to look up, just, you know, building going on, the conditions set so that developers have been able to build.
For the poor and the middle class, New York is an increasingly unaffordable place to live. But there are more jobs here than ever. Robert Wolf had Obama's ear for 8 years. And so I ask him why it can feel so hard to make it here, even though we're doing so much better.
Is there anything you think that the president maybe wishes he'd done differently with the economy?
Yeah, listen, I think if you ask the president, does he wish he could get wages up higher? Okay, wages really the first year they really came up with is in the past year. I think wages are up 5%.
He's saying the policies were the right ones. He just wishes the outcomes had been better. For WNYC, I'm Ilya Meritz.
From November 4th, 2008 to November 8th, 2016, New Yorkers experienced a vast slide in mood. For 8 years, Brian Lehrer presided as New Yorkers danced, argued, and ultimately cried. As part of our series, The Obama Years, The View from New York, WNYC's Andrea Bernstein speaks to Brian about how our sense of community shifted, beginning on the night Obama first won the presidency, when both of them were on the air.
Out of many, we are one. That while we breathe, we hope. And where we are met with cynicism and doubt, and those who tell us that we can't, we will respond with that timeless creed that sums up the spirit of a people. Yes, we can. Thank you. God bless you. And may God bless the United States of America.
On election night of 2008, many New Yorkers were dancing in the streets. Seriously. So Brian Lehrer did what Brian does. Open the phones.
Our lines are already full. Andrea Bernstein, I can hardly believe that there's an audience out there at this hour, but of course, this is not any night.
Hey, we're here in the Bronx. Obama, Obama, Obama.
In the early morning after the 2016 election, Brian opened the phones again.
Eve, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling us so early in the day.
I told my students that when they wake up tomorrow, they're going to see a female president. And I'm walking into my class today feeling so distraught. The tears have not stopped.
My kids are still sleeping. My wife has been crying all night long. I am looking for some advisor to tell me what to tell my kids.
Oh, boy.
Between those two polls lies a whole sphere of emotion, filtered these past 8 years by Brian Lehrer behind the red microphone in Control Room 2, where I'm sitting now. Through the fight over the Affordable Care Act, climate change, the rise of the Tea Party, Storm Sandy, the gay marriage decision, and of course, the election of 2016. Joining me now, behind the blue mic, on the other side of the table, is Brian Lehrer. So let's start with 2008. We were here in this room. What do you remember it feeling like?
Andrew, that was one of the most memorable days I've ever had on the air, and that probably produced the single most euphoric block of calls we've gotten from listeners. And I think it was caused by a few things, really. Certainly that we elected our first black president gave so many Americans goosebumps, including so many white Americans and even a lot of John McCain voters, honestly. Just the fact that history could move from the worst old days to that. But also at that moment, because there would be no more George W. Bush. It's easy to forget with how horrified most of our area is today about Trump, just how reviled Bush and Dick Cheney were for their combined legacy of the Iraq War and the financial crisis and things. And it was like, ding dong, the witch is dead, politically speaking. And for that combination of reasons, boy, you could feel the ecstasy on the phones.
I took a cab from Midtown Manhattan back to Queens, and the entire way back it was people screaming and, you know, having a good time, honking their horns, you know, like a guy, you know, jumped out in front of my cab and was like, Obama!
Turning down Broadway, a skateboarder appeared in front of us. And check this image. It was a young man on a skateboard with a huge American flag riding down Broadway.
Yeah, I mean, when I listen to the tape from 2008, one of the things I think is, boy, we had no idea what was coming. Even between then and 2012, there was such a sense of the kind of the beginning of the tearing down of political civility, which we saw obviously at its height in this campaign. But, you know, the rise of the Tea Party, the fight over Obamacare, of course, the dark money that was unleashed by Citizens United and all those negative ads, there was a sense of we are no longer talking to each other. And I'm wondering, for you sitting behind this microphone, if you had a sense of presiding over the fraying of a common culture.
Definitely. And over time, support for Obama among the callers who supported him became more sober and sometimes ambivalent, because they saw him as under constant attack by a completely rejectionist Republican Party on the one hand. So Hope and Change, capital H, capital C, became try to fight for what scraps you could get. And ambivalent because of things like drone strikes and sometimes seeming to fight without enough vigor. And so by the time he was reelected in 2012, we got callers the next day who voted for Obama but sounded like this. Remember what it sounded like in 2008. It sounded like this in 2012.
The moneyed interest did not win. There was so much money, corporate money, poured into defeating Obama and many other Democrats.
The jubilation that Obama supporters like myself, or some like myself, may feel today, I think it's going to be counterproductive if we fail to learn a lesson of 2008, and that is to just go back to sleep after the election.
In thinking about that tape from 2012, one of the things that I feel like was a lesson for Obama supporters was that the out of many one center was going to hold, and that there still was a body politic, a place where these discussions could be had. And I think that's one of the problems that you and I mean certainly a lot of other people, but us in our conversations when we were talking about Trump in the early part of his candidacy, he seemed so outside of the political sphere that it was hard for us to imagine that he could be successful. And I'm wondering if that is sort of part of Obama's tangled legacy, that he created a sense that politics existed in a particular place on a particular trajectory, and it was hard to process the Trump candidacy because Obama had us thinking in a certain direction.
And when we've taken calls, the thing that comes up over and over again, which I think goes to your point, is his character. And yet we learn from this year's election the limits of character and the language of unity as a motivating force in politics, given what we know about Trump's behavior and yet the fervor of his supporters despite so many things.
Being in the position that you are, a convener of conversations, a place where all kinds of people call and speak to you, where do you see yourself going from here, given the fact that even the very basic sense that there's a common place in which we talk has been frayed? What does that mean for you?
There has to be a common place in which we can talk. And for me, on my show, we're still dedicated to being one of those places.
Since 2008, more than 200 baby Baracks were born in the United States. As part of our series, The Obama Years, The View from New York, WNYC's Yasmin Khan spoke to one of them. He lives and goes to school in Manhattan.
Hi, my name is Barack Chad Joseph Tiller. I am 7 years old. I really thought that a lot of people would name their children after Barack because it was like the first black president. My parents were really excited.
Hi, my name is Temeca Tillard, and I'm Barack Tillard's mom.
My name is Conrad Tillard, and I'm Barack's dad.
I was pregnant with our Barack in 2008, and some of the commonalities I felt like I had with Barack Obama were things like Hawaii. My family is from Hawaii. I, too, have a black Muslim father, a non-black mother.
Obviously, the first African-American president, we were very, very excited around that time, as everybody was. And in fact, we were in Brooklyn at the time, and as a minister, The Brooklyn political establishment was very much in support of Barack Obama early. So we were very excited about that. And we couldn't think of a better name.
I hear people talking about our president. Some are rude to the president, and I think that's a little disrespectful. President Obama used to take karate like me. I learned a lot from him from the past all of my life. I learned that to be a leader, and my two parents taught me to be a leader too.
In the Obama years, outsider artists, musicians, and writers suddenly found themselves inside the mainstream and often inside the White House. For New York's culture producers, and particularly non-white and women artists, that represented a sea change in opportunities, audience, and expectations. As part of our series, The Obama Years, The View from New York, WNYC's Arun Venugopal reflects on what happens when outsider art becomes insider art.
In May of 2009, in the early days of the Obama era, the White House held a poetry jam, and out walked a young man sporting short hair and a sharp black suit, sounding like he was just out of college.
I'm actually working on a hip-hop album.
It was Lin-Manuel Miranda.
It's a concept album about the life of someone I think embodies hip-hop, Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton. You laugh, but it's true.
There was the president holding his hand over his mouth to suppress a smile, while Michelle Obama laughed out loud. Remember, this was 6 years before Hamilton the Musical, well before Lin-Manuel Miranda became a household name.
How does a bastard orphan son of a whore and a Scotsman...
Outside, the U.S. economy was in free fall. Unemployment was about to hit 10%. But in here, the White House was ahead of the curve. The president and his aides were leading a conversation on art and culture that would have a profound influence on the country.
Maybe it's the most conscientious White House that we've had. I dare to say ever, because I have only been around for a few decades.
Writer, comedian, and cultural critic Baratunde Thurston, a regular guest of the White House.
Go to whitehouse.gov/performances and see Queen Latifah, Mavis Staples, Alabama Shakes,
Esperanza Spalding, Audra McDonald.
I can't stop talking about him and talking about him and talking about him. I can't stop talking about him, the man that I adore. I can't
Booker
stop
T. Jones, Justin Timberlake, Arturo Sandoval and Stevie Wonder, Lau Lovett, Keb Moe.
Well, remember, if you can, when cotton was picked by hand.
This is a White House that recognizes that one of its greatest powers is the power to convene, and the power to elevate, and the power to, in a sense, like, retweet.
I can see my future, I can feel my past.
And I think why that's so powerful is that a lot of these types of voices are not the kind that have had historic access to power.
Meaning black voices, Latinos, Asian Americans, and Native Americans.
Praise song for the day.
Almost exactly 8 years ago today, poet Elizabeth Alexander stood on the Mall before a crowd of almost 2 million to mark the inauguration of the nation's first black president.
Say it plain, that many have died for this day. Sing the names of the dead who brought us here, who laid the train tracks, raised the bridges, picked the cotton and the lettuce.
I think that the vision was to say, first of all, in the White House, what would be on the walls? Who would come in and play music? Who would be invited to come in and hear that music?
I spoke to Elizabeth Alexander this month at her home on the Upper West Side.
What's high culture? What's so-called low culture? And can we think of those things on a similar plane in some instances? What is American creative expressive excellence?
It helped that the Obamas are sophisticated consumers of culture. They're paying attention to what the kids are listening to, along with Charles Mingus and Howlin' Wolf. Alexander said that when it came to the programming in the White House, there was a clear effort to communicate the things that can't easily be captured in a speech.
What art can do is capture us at the emotional level. It can capture us at the level of contradiction.
A friend who worked in the administration told me the idea was that artists weren't there simply to perform, but as part of the very fabric of the White House. Here's Frank Ocean at the Italian State Dinner. There's Chance the Rapper. And it wasn't just celebrities. The door was open to all kinds of writers, activists, and community organizers. Kehan Irani is a storyteller from Queens and was honored as a champion of change. When she arrived at the White House wearing her royal blue sari, she was cynical, figuring that since it was Asian Pacific Heritage Month, this is all just a PR exercise. But
the whole day, the message from everyone was that you're welcome here. This is your place. You have a home here. It makes me want to cry just thinking about it now. You know, I'm like, can't look at you right now because, you know, it's going to make me cry.
Kehan was there with her parents. They had moved with her from India decades ago when she was just 4 and experienced a loss of status. They'd been middle class, but now they were working class. People insulted them and made racist jibes, teased them for their accents. So as a human rights activist, her feelings about going to a White House event were complicated.
But to see the intentionality behind it and to feel it in every small gesture really made my heart full. And in some way it did make me mature as an individual, because I think you can get stuck in an immature way of saying, well, this country doesn't want me, and screw them and screw everyone. And I had to recognize that I am American. I'm American. I'm 100% American.
And for some Americans watching from afar, perhaps it was a little too much. The president's meeting with Kendrick Lamar in the Oval Office. The cavalcade of pop stars like Beyonce, Jay-Z, writers of color, people who speak out against the criminal justice system or police shootings or imperialism, not to mention the sheer effortless glamour of it all. Baratunde Thurston.
When you're not used to being challenged, anything that challenges you feels overwhelming. And that's the history we got to deal with. Like, it's hundreds of years of that. I get how that'd be a lot to swallow. It can feel like a cultural assault.
But in addition to being consumers of art and conveners of art, the Obamas are artists and performers themselves. The First Lady danced before us and with us. And the president, he was our performer in chief. We knew long ago how eloquent he could be. The oration, the perfect turn of phrase. But after years of Obama the thoughtful, Obama the wise, we were treated to Obama the halting singer, leading a crowd in church after the Charleston shootings.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound.
Through art, the president insisted that at some level, he was still one of us, that he was vulnerable, and with his creaking, off-pitch, imperfect self, he drew us closer, walked us past the curtains and the velvet ropes and all the stagecraft.
It just so happens that we celebrate our country's birthday on the same day that we celebrate my oldest daughter's birthday. So just a quick happy birthday for Malia. Happy birthday to you.
The leader of the free world felt fine about singing off key.
You. Happy birthday.
For 8 years, the president, along with the artists that he championed, reminded us that the republic is deeply flawed. But it's no less worthy of our love.
Thank you, everybody. God bless you. God bless America.
For WNYC, I'm Arun Venugopal.
Barack Obama visited New York City at least 32 times as president. As part of our series, The Obama Years, The View from New York, WNYC's Jim O'Grady reports that the president came to the Big Apple for the same reasons a lot of people do, to make money, eat good food, and catch a show.
It all started with date night.
President Obama took First Lady Michelle out on a date night in Manhattan over the weekend.
During Obama's first presidential campaign in 2008, when things were getting crazy hectic, he'd promised Michelle, when this thing is over, I'm going to take you out to dinner and a show. So yeah, New York. Blue Hill Restaurant in the West Village with its super mashup cuisine of kohlrabi burritos and beer ice cream. Then on to Broadway for the August Wilson play Joe Turner's Come and Gone, with its characters who do what they have to do to get by, like this sassy lady telling her landlord how it's going to be.
Look here, Mr. Holly, I forgot to tell you, I likes me some company from time to time. I don't like being by myself.
Well, your business is your business.
Except if you're president, and then you're everybody's business. On the surface, date night was an early introduction to America's freshly minted glamour couple. Crowds lost it as their motorcade passed through Times Square. But under the surface, an anti-Obama smear machine was already gearing up. It started with date night. Critics harped on its costs to the taxpayer, complaints that mushroomed over time into cries of scandal about the frequency and supposed extravagance of Obama's trips as president. The website factcheck.org says that among its most frequently asked questions are, did Bo the first dog really have his own separate plane? No, he did not. Did Obama travel and vacation less than his predecessor, George W. Bush? Yes, he did. It's become a theme over the last 8 years of our national politics, the loss of early luster, fairly or not, and the lowering of expectations. You can see it subtly playing out in Obama's relationship to New York, where the president came not just for culture, but cash. Getting it? And dealing with the loss of trillions in the Great Recession.
Financial weapons of mass destruction.
In 2010, the president stood on Cooper Union's historic stage and talked Wall Street reform. He praised legislation intended to stabilize financial markets and make them more transparent.
And that's why reform will rein in excess and help ensure that these kinds of transactions take place in the light of day.
That more or less became the Dodd-Frank Act, which helped lay the groundwork for years of recovery. But observers also pointed out the tension in Obama's relationship to New York's financial industry. One of those was broadcaster Laura Flanders, speaking outside Cooper Union's Great Hall.
2 years ago on the campaign, he not only gave a speech here calling for reform, but also went to meet with Wall Street bankers and others to gather contributions for his
Like
campaign.
A lot of people, Obama came here to tap New York's spigot of capital. On the one hand, he was playing by the rules of the game. On the other, that meant hobnobbing with the prosperous.
Candidates will come to New York a number of times.
That's Sarah Kovner. She and her husband, Victor Kovner.
I practice law with a firm of Davis Wright Tremaine.
Are longtime supporters of the Democratic National Committee. They know a lot about the fundraising circuit and how a candidate will hit Houston and Chicago.
And they'll go to California, maybe to San Francisco and Los Angeles a couple of times. But for every time they go there, they'll come to New York four or five times.
The Kovners hosted a fundraiser for President Obama in March of 2012 in their apartment on West 67th Street. 120 people jammed into their home.
It was tight.
Most had paid $5,000 to get in. The donors sat in folding chairs or sipped wine while standing next to large panes of bulletproof glass placed in front of the windows. Beforehand, the Secret Service sat Sarah down and instructed her, no drinking glasses in the hands of the guests in the first two rows. Those could be used as weapons.
I said, well, you know, they're not going to throw anything at him.
They've given $5,000.
Yeah, they've given $5,000. They didn't come here to throw a glass at him.
The donors kept their glasses. This was the first of three fundraisers held for Obama that evening, a typical arrangement on his trips to New York. The Kovners say the events brought in north of $1.5 million. They also say, no kidding, it was a highlight of their lives.
He is a person of such quality. We share his values deeply. He expresses them in a forceful, compelling manner. It was, I have to say, profoundly moving.
When not raking in the dough, Obama would occasionally chill out and buff his regular guy image by cracking jokes with the locals. Jon Stewart at The Daily Show and Jimmy Fallon, with whom he famously slow jammed the news.
Through the actions of my administration, we were able to stimulate the economy and get our country back on track.
Oh, yeah.
Obama was not a newbie to New York. In his 20s, he lived with a girlfriend in Brownstone, Brooklyn, and he spent 2 years at Columbia University. Naturally, there's a debunked conspiracy theory claiming he never went there. In his memoir, Dreams from My Father, Obama tells a story about being a young man and flying into town and showing up at a friend's apartment on West 109th Street, a friend who forgot he was coming. Obama ended up sleeping in an alley and in the morning bathing at a fire hydrant with a homeless guy. 28 years later, dressed in a tailored suit, Obama stood at the podium in the United Nations General Assembly Hall.
It is my honor to address you for the first time as the 44th president of the United States.
That first trip to the international body went so well, it was sort of like date night two. The UN was captivated by Obama, who said he was very attracted to the UN's mission.
It is my deeply held belief that in the year 2009, more than at any point in human history, the interests of nations and peoples are shared.
Globalism, diversity, cross-cultural exchange. Obama embodies those things as deeply as they reside in the heart of New York. But as Stuart Patrick, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, says, Obama's comfort with New York and the affection he gets from New Yorkers makes other Americans suspicious.
To the degree that they associate New York as being cosmopolitan and internationalist, it can be tarred with the same brush of being either, you know, elitist or out of touch with Main Street USA.
Obama did score victories at the UN, like the Paris Accord on climate change. But over time, the romance faded.
Towards the last couple of years, he sounded increasingly wistful. It was almost like he was an enlightened guy who, in a sense, was inhabiting an unreasonable world.
What you might call the world we live in now. For WNYC, I'm Jim O'Grady.
His first two terms ended in such a hurry. Wish he could go for three like my man Steph Curry.
Now, there will be no third term. I can't stay forever. Besides, Daddy's got a Hawaiian vacation booked in about 223 days. But who's counting?
Please join me in welcoming our nation's next First Lady, Michelle Obama.
The minute Michelle Obama rolls up to the podium at the 2008 Democratic National Convention wearing that mint green dress, hair laid to the gods, with her trademark poise and ineffable ease, it's quite clear that she did not come to play. Honestly, when she rolls up anywhere, it's pretty clear she did not come to play. She shows up to engage, to deliver what might as well be straight intellectual activism. Every time, right up to the end, like during this commencement address in 2016 at the City College of New York in Harlem.
And that is how all those infusions of new cultures and ideas, generation after generation, created the matchless alchemy of our melting pot and helped us build the strongest, most vibrant, most prosperous nation on the planet. Right here.
An alchemist might be one way to describe her, but she's also an unparalleled role model, relentless in her efforts to impress the importance of self-confidence onto young girls.
If I had worried about who liked me and who thought I was cute when I was your age, I wouldn't be married to the President of the United States today. So
I hear that vibrant confidence in her voice, and I marvel at the thought of how my own little brown self would have been influenced growing up with Michelle in the White House. As a black adoptee in a white family, I was surrounded by anti-reflections, inundated by unremitting standards of white beauty. My fifth grade teacher, who was mean anyway, made sure to let me know that I was less than all the others. Very pretty, she said, for a black girl. Most black girls aren't that pretty. I can't imagine that Michelle would internalize the comment the way that I did. She couldn't have and then still gone on to become who she is and to withstand such insane public scrutiny. Because you know what she does with public scrutiny? She turns up.
Turn up for what?
She parodied Lil Jon's hit, Turn Down for What, with a turnip, and it went viral. She danced to Uptown Funk, she shimmied with Jimmy Fallon, and she rapped about college.
FLOTUS on the track.
Southside Chicago, we all know we had to do overtime every night to make it tomorrow.
Michelle Obama's sense of self is distinctly rooted in humor, tenacity, and resolute blackness. She's the embodiment of what black American writer Zora Neale Hurston meant. She wrote, I love myself when I am laughing, and then again when I'm looking mean and impressive. Michelle Obama is a civil disruptor with a radical kind of benevolence, like at the DNC last summer when she took the stage and within seconds changed the entire tenor of the room.
How we insist that the hateful language they hear from public figures on TV does not represent the true spirit of this country. How we explain that when someone is cruel or acts like a bully, you don't stoop to their level. No, our motto is, when they go low, we go high.
And it would all be an act if it wasn't. Some might even argue that this is precisely what politicians do and who they are. Polished, well-prepared, articulate, unflappable. But Michelle Obama is not so much a politician as she is a manifester, the hyper-spectacular incarnation of a black woman unbound. It would be easy to trot out that strong black woman stereotype here, as many did at the start of Obama's presidency. She talked with Oprah about that recently.
When you were labeled that angry black woman, was that one of the things that knocked you back a bit?
Well, that was one of those things that you just sort of think, dang, you don't even know me.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, you just sort of feel like, wow, where'd that come from?
Yeah.
What Michelle Obama did as First Lady of the United States was take the strong black woman stereotype and laugh, then kick its ass, and then tell it to move on out of her way. You see, Michelle Obama has no use for stereotypes. It's that full immersion, that gratitude and integrity regarding her blackness that represents, to my mind, the most appreciable reason that Barack chose her. I might be less inclined to be so bold in my presumption about why the President of the United States loves his wife, if not for the deep well of empathy I have for the younger Barack Obama, the Barack in his book, Dreams from My Father. Obama writes, "I was trying to raise myself to be a black man in America, and beyond the given of my appearance, no one around me seemed to know exactly what that meant." Well, Michelle Obama knew what that meant.
When people ask me whether being in the White House has changed my husband, I can honestly say that when it comes to his character and his convictions and his heart, Barack Obama is still the same man I fell in love with all those years ago.
I myself had every intention of marrying a black man. That was the mandate. He would eclipse any and all remnants of an identity shaped by the white people I was surrounded by growing up. It didn't end up that way for me because ultimately you love who you love. And also, if you're black, turns out who you marry doesn't make you any more or less so. But I understand and recognize that Barack Obama could not deny himself the company of Michelle, a woman who loves herself and her blackness when she's laughing and then again when she's looking mean and impressive.
At last, my love has come along. My lonely days are over, and life is like a song. Oh, yeah, yeah, at last. The skies above are blue. My heart was wrapped up in clover.
As a presidential candidate in 2008, Barack Obama promised 14 million immigrants without legal status, including some 750,000 in New York, that he would introduce immigration reform in his first year in office. It became known in the Latino community as La Promesa de Obama, Obama's promise. But then something unexpected happened. As part of our series, The Obama Years, The View from New York, WNYC's Sarah Gonzalez reports.
For immigrants and immigrant families, in 2008, Senator Barack Obama became the realization of the ultimate American dream.
His background from an immigrant family.
Just his background, with his dad being from Kenya.
We're going to tell all those older Latinos that Barack Obama, listen, that doesn't leave this room, is Dominican. Then he's one of us.
For Latinos in particular, the largest immigrant group in the country, every fight won by the black community paved the way for Latino rights.
From the sit-ins to desegregate, the fight for citizenship rights, we have seen the future, and the future is ours. Gracias.
Se puede. Sí, se puede. Yes, we can. Those three words spoke to the hearts of Latinos, says Jorge Ramos. Hi, Jorge Ramos.
Chara, how are you?
What are you working on? Honestly, I can't really believe that I'm talking to you.
Why not?
Jorge Ramos has been called the most trusted and influential voice in the Latino voting bloc. As a journalist with the largest Spanish language news network in the country, Univision, Ramos is one of the most recognized Latinos among the 57 million Latinos in the United States. And he interviewed President Obama four times.
Remember, he started using this phrase, si se puede, yes we can.
Yes, we can.
That actually was taken from two great Latinos, Dolores Huerta and Cesar Chavez.
Si se puede was the rallying cry of the farm worker rights movement in the 1960s.
Those were the connections with Barack Obama. And it worked for him. It really worked for him.
A mariachi group in Texas wrote Obama a traditional Mexican corrido.
El candidato, ¿quién es Barack Obama?
10 million Latinos came out for the general election, and 67% voted for Obama.
Viva Obama!
Viva!
No one expected Barack Obama would become the president to deport more people than any other president in U.S. history.
No, nobody, not at the beginning.
Obama's Homeland Security deported 2.7 million people, an average of 1,000 immigrants a day for 8 years, earning him the title of Deporter-in-Chief. And in 2014, Jorge Ramos asked the president to explain that title. How did Obama respond to that?
He didn't like it.
Jorge, we're not going to.
For 6 years, you destroyed many families.
Jorge,
you
called me deporter in chief. I did not.
And that was our last interview.
That was your after last that, interview?
That was the last interview I had with him. He didn't want to talk to me afterwards.
In his first year in office, Obama did not introduce comprehensive immigration reform, despite his promise. Instead, he focused on health care and the economy. In 2010, Democrats lost control of Congress, and that's when immigration reform died. Meanwhile, the U.S. was deporting thousands. Obama has said he had to enforce immigration laws. They are laws. But in 2010, the Obama administration did say that people without criminal records would no longer be priorities. Families were affected anyway.
Soy Maria Lara Herrera.
Maria Lara Herrera and I spoke over a bad cell phone connection.
Sí.
¿Y estás en Tijuana?
Sí, estoy en Tijuana.
She was deported after living and working in San Diego for 25 years without a criminal record. She and her husband got pulled over on the freeway and immigration agents showed up. 5 kids were left behind. Rosa Arzate, the oldest, only has a visa. She's allowed to be in the U.S., but she's not allowed to leave the country. She can't visit her parents. Her dad died 2 months ago, and she watched his funeral through the camera of her sister's iPhone.
4 years I've never seen him, and now to see him only in FaceTime, I cannot even touch him and then not see my mom how she cried. It's really hard for me. But
the pressure from Republicans for Obama to crack down even more on illegal immigration was relentless. In 2014, he announced he would use his executive power to protect 740,000 young people known as Dreamers from deportation. This was a big deal.
You'll be able to apply to stay in this country temporarily without fear of deportation. You can come out of the shadows.
He tried to give the same protection to up to 5 million parents of U.S. citizens, but a 2016 Supreme Court tie blocked it from going forward.
I think it is heartbreaking for the millions of immigrants who made their lives here, who've raised families here.
But while he was saying things like that, deportation still continued, and a focus was on families and children fleeing Central America. Even after Donald Trump was elected, on January 4th, just days ago, the Obama administration confirmed a new wave of immigration raids. This should come as no surprise, the Secretary of Homeland Security wrote. Families and unaccompanied children will be removed. Journalist Jorge Ramos.
That's the part of Barack Obama that I do not understand. I don't know why he's doing that, even today.
Lawyers, activists, scholars, and even the staunchest Obama supporters also can't figure out why.
I think all Latinos understand all the great things that he did for the Dreamers, that he was the one pushing for immigration reform in Congress. And then this incredible surprise that he's still deporting.
Over Obama's entire presidency, just about half of the people who were deported had no criminal record. That's according to data from Immigration and Customs Enforcement. But in recent years, most of them were recent arrivals, people apprehended at or near the border, which is in line with Obama's priorities. Today, the U.S. border is the most policed it's ever been, and the flow of illegal immigration is the lowest since the 1970s. Still, Donald Trump ran a campaign ridiculing Obama's actions on immigration as simply not enough. Trump's policies are expected to be far harsher. But this story ends where it began. Jorge Ramos says the very fact that Barack Obama, the son of an immigrant, became president, leaves Latinos with hope. Hope that they could one day be a Supreme Court justice like Sonia Sotomayor, and hope that a Latino could also be president one day. Ramos says he's absolutely convinced that that person has already been born.
Juan in Los Angeles, or Pedro in Miami, or Sofia in New York could be one day the president or la presidenta of the United States. He did it. We can do it too.
For WNYC, I'm Sarah Gonzalez.